accession number 23205, reel 1-2.
Tony Leake, reel 2.
In the transit camp, where, as I've mentioned, there was very high security, they had a large marquee there with, in which we were briefed with air photos, and they had an enormous model of the area where we were supposed to be dropping, the assault area for the 6th Airborne Division. And it was incredibly detailed, with trees and down to trees and every little field. It must have taken an awful lot of making, and we were shown exactly where we were going to land and the general layout of the land, and you got a very good picture from this model. I think they have a model either in Normandy or at the Airborne Forces Museum in Aldershot. And of course we were very fortunate in this briefing that we would, it was done so well, because compared with the 1st Airborne Division in, at Arnhem, they had to get ready in a few days and they had nothing like this sort of preparation. And we didn't get anything, any briefing as good as this when we went on the airborne operation over the Rhine. Anyway, we had all that done, and we just sort of took life easy most of the time. There wasn't much to do. It was a horrible thought that a lot of the people there would be dead or wounded in the next few days, but there we were. We were due to take off on the night of the 4th of June, but the weather conditions were bad, and so the whole operation was delayed for 24 hours. I mean, that's common knowledge, but I mean, I'm just reinforced. So we got all ready to go, and then we didn't go, so we had an extra 24 hours before we were going to go. And the second time, well, they said, it's on tonight, and I've read since that it hadn't gone then, they'd have had to wait for the weather and moon conditions for another month. They hadn't gone on the 5th of June. And they had services, and, you know, and singing, "Oh God, I help in ages past, and abide with me," and you felt as though that you were in the valley of the shadow of death and all that. And then that evening we had a good meal, and we got some soot from the boilers of the kitchens, the cookhouse, smeared it on our face to make ourselves look less conspicuous. Got all our stuff and paraded and went off onto the airfield and collected our chutes and got on board. And we had an awful lot of weight of kit to carry. When you got your chute on with all your ammunition and everything else, you were carrying about 100 pounds weight of kit. The chute itself weighed about 23 pounds, but even without the chute, it was still a lot of weight with ammunition and your rifle. And I mean, and I had a, what they call a bundle. Do you know anything about parachuting?
Not very much.
Well, it was introduced soon after, about the time I was, or just before I went on the parachute course. It's what they call kit bag jumps. Now, the kit bag was a big padded army kit bag, and you could put things in it like the barrel of a machine gun or parts of a 3-inch mortar, heavy equipment, and it was padded, and you jumped with this on your leg, and it was attached by a sort of recess into this bag, and you put your leg in it, and it had two quick release straps which you pulled out, and a string attached to your parachute harness at one end and the other end to the kit bag. It was about 20 feet to long, and the idea was, as soon as your chute had opened, you released your kit bag, and so the kit bag would land before you did, and not only that, you'd have an easier landing because you weren't yourself carrying as much weight, and also The kit bag had the effect of slowing you down at the last minute while you landed. And but not everybody had kit bags. The light machine guns and the rifles with which we were equipped were put in what they called a rifle valise, which was a thick felt sleeved thing like a big sock, and you shoved it in that, and that had a string attached like the kit bag and a quick release. And also everybody had to carry, unless you were carrying a Bren gun, a light machine gun, which was about 23 pounds weight, a rifle weighed about 9 pounds, you had to carry a pick or a shovel as well, full sized one strapped to it. And I had a shovel, an army shovel. It's a sort of spade shovel with a sort of pointed one. And we had these as well. And we got on the plane with all this lot. And we hooked up. Now, by hooking up, I mean we connected the static line coming out of your chute. And it ended in a sort of D-shaped ring. And that clipped on to the strop, which was another static line. And the other end of the strop was attached to a wire cable, which ran along one side of the plane opposite to the door, where it was securely fixed. So that when you jumped, I mean, of course, the strop was fixed in the plane. And then as you jumped out, as I told you before, you jumped out, and then when the chute was pulled out, the 100-pound tie broke, and you were free. I should mention that occasionally these 100-pound ties didn't break. And I have seen a parachutist on a training flight from the ground fly around, hanging underneath the plane. And how they got them back was they lowered one of these kit bags I've told you about on a rope, and they got the fella to get hold of it, and they gradually dragged him in. But it was a very nerve-wracking business for the parachutist. So what they usually did, they took him up again with a new chute and made him jump again, else he'd lost his nerve. I mean, occasionally a chute didn't open. And of course, that was nothing you could do about that, because the British ideas were different from the Americans. The Americans jumped at a higher altitude, about 1,000 feet, and they had a reserve chute. So that if the main chute didn't work, they could pull the ripcord on this reserve chute. Now, the British idea was different. The British idea was that you didn't have a reserve chute. The chances of a chute not opening were very remote. And so you could drop parachutists at a lower altitude, down as low as 400 feet. And with the Americans, if they dropped with a spare chute, they were a target in the air for longer. As you can imagine, twice as long as the British parachutists. And it was felt that the spare chute wasn't justified. And this has happened more recently about parachuting, that they adopted the American way for a time some years ago. And now they've gone back to the one chute at a lower altitude, which I think, my own personal view, is that it's a better idea. Anyway, that's by the by. We got in the plane. We hooked up, and you checked that you were hooked up in the correct place, and you sat down. Now, in the coat of the seats along each side of the aircraft, parallel to the fuselage, and they go alternatively right and left, 1, 2, 3, 4 sort of, and they would take up to 20 men. And They flew with the door off in the Dakota. All the way, it wasn't taken off during flight. You couldn't have done it, I don't think, anyway. And then I was jumping quite late on. I was number 16. So there were, 15 people in front of me. And the planes flew from, this Blakehill Farm Airfield is in Gloucestershire. If you flew straight to Normandy, you could do it in an hour. But we took off about 11, and we weren't due to land until 10 to 1. So they flew round in circles for an hour, getting all into formation. And then there were three waves of British aircraft which went over the south coast here, over Worthing and Littlehampton and Bognor, I think. And headed for Normandy. And then changed direction slightly so that they crossed the French coast near a place called Cobourg. And went to, slightly southwest to land up at the dropping zone. Now, 8th Battalion were due to be the troops who were dropped the furthest inland of the 6th Airborne Division. And when we landed, we were the furthest troops inland of all the British assault forces, and it would be about, our dropping zone DZ was about 8 miles from the coast, 7 or 8 miles due south of the coast. Now, the 6th Airborne's objectives were to capture the bridge, Pegasus Bridge they call it now, which is over the Caen Canal, which is a ship canal. It would take boats, biggish boats, right into the port of Caen, 10 miles from the sea. A wide ship canal. And the bridge over the River Orne at Ranville, which was about half a mile away. The 9th Battalion had to capture the gun battery at Merville, which you've probably heard about, which was the worst task of all. And the 8th Battalion and the 1st Canadian, in the brigade there was the 8th, 9th and 1st Canadian Battalions. They only had one battalion of parachutists anyway, the Canadians. And their job was to destroy two of the bridges over the River Dives, and 8th Battalion to destroy three. But we weren't to do it ourselves. We didn't do the actual demolitions. That was the 3rd Parachute Squadron RE that John Shaver talked about was in. And they was under the command of the 8th Battalion, and they one of their troops was with the Canadians and two were with the 8th Battalion. Now, there were approximately 650 jumpers in a parachute battalion, and in addition to that, we had 6 gliders. I'm giving you a thing about the gliders I did last year about the 8th Battalion gliders. These gliders carried the one was the carried medical supplies. Two carried the engineers and their heavy demolition equipment, and three were for the 8th Battalion with their reserve ammunition, machine guns and 3-inch mortars. And they were due to drop to land just before we jumped, about 5 minutes, which was about half an hour after the gliders had landed at Pegasus Bridge. This has been well publicised. It's been over publicised about what they did at Pegasus Bridge, because they had an easy time of it in some ways compared with what the other units did. And then, now what before, at the same time as they landed at Pegasus Bridge, which was about 12:20, half an hour before we were due to drop, we had what they called the Pathfinders. These were two aircraft with took off from Harwell, where the Atomic Energy Place is now. And it took about 10 men each. And their job was to mark out the drop-in zones and the glider landing zones. They had these radar beacons, which and so the planes could home in on them. Now, the trouble was that the Pathfinders weren't very good at finding the path. And one plane was correct and got it on the right DZ, the correct DZ, and the other one got it on the wrong DZ, where all the other units of the 6th Airborne were dropping, or most of them, near Arnville, about 3 miles away. So when we came to drop, half of the battalion were dropped, or should have been, should have landed on the correct DZ, and half of them landed amongst all these other units, 7th, 12th and 13th battalion at Ranville.
Which did you drop in?
I dropped on by the correct DZ, well, a bit south of it, because there was a bit of a, just south of the, next to the main road that runs from Rouen to Caen. It's the old Roman road from Caen to Rouen. I dropped perhaps about a mile south of where I should have done, but not far. I wasn't far out anyway. But the trouble in our plane was, when we crossed the coast, the planes, by the way, had a 250-pound bomb on board, which they dropped as they crossed the coast, just to confuse the Germans that we were bombers. And they started shooting at us, and the plane was rattling away like a tin can, and they were taking a bit of evasive action. They flew on course pretty well, our plane, because the British didn't fly in formation on these operations. They were all different heights and different, or different heights until they got to the DZ. And when we got to the DZ, the plane should have slowed down to about 120 miles an hour. But they didn't. They flew on at maximum throttle. And so when the parachutists jumped, they were scattered far more than they should have been. Because I can remember that, because when you were parachuting on the training, you could always hear the plane throttling back and getting down to almost what they call stalling speed, you know, going as low as safely possible. But these didn't stop at all. They just bashed on as fast as they could. Now, the trouble on our plane was the first man, an officer, jumped, and his batman, who was number two, fell down in the doorway. So there was a delay whilst they got him to his feet and pushed him out, you see. And then I was, as I said, number 16. Now, number 15, in front of me, he turned around in the doorway and said, "I'm not hooked up." I said, "You are," and I pushed him out, hooked up or not. We couldn't wait any longer. I know it sounds a bit hard, but, you know, I knew he'd be hooked up, because it's all been checked and double-checked. But somehow he got into this panic. And so, with those two things, there was a bit of delay, and I landed further south than I should have done, what with the fella falling down and the anyone turning around in the doorway and flying too fast. And I landed. I could see where I was coming down, because it wasn't total darkness. There was a moon with some cloud. It was bricks in the cloud. And I landed in this little orchard between the rail. I'll show them up.
Nobody, The third parties can't see the map anyway.
No. I landed in this little strip of land, which was an orchard between the railway and the main road, which ran parallel there. Now, I went through the tree and landed all right. My kit, rifle and spade, and also the small rucksack thing, were up in the tree. And I couldn't pull it down. I was just going to climb the tree to get it down. It's a good job I didn't, because a German car came whizzing past at full speed, but they never saw me, fortunately. I think they were too busy with other things. Anyway, I pulled and pulled, and it came down after about 5 minutes, so I was all right. So I collected all my stuff and made my way across the railway, and I had to be very careful because I thought the railway might be under fire, you see. And I got across all right, there was no opposition there. And I got onto the... I got my sense of direction right, with knowing where the railway was, because I knew that ran east and west, almost due east and west. So if I went north, I'd be okay, and I did. And I eventually came to the rendezvous, what they call the RV. And they were firing these Veery lights at the RV. Do you know what a Veery light is?
Yes.
Yeah. Just to try and help us find them. And I knew I was okay in this field. It hadn't been mined because there were cows in the field. Because the Germans had put up anti-parachute poles, not where we jumped, but nearer the coast at Ranville. And of course there could have been mines, anti-personnel mines. Anyway, I got to the RV. And there were very few people there. I think I got there about an hour after I dropped. And now I'm not quite sure on these figures, but probably about 100 people there, 100 8th Battalion soldiers there. And there should have been about 750, because there should have been about 650 of the 8th Battalion and getting on for 100 of the 3rd Paris Squadron engineers. But Alistair Pearson was there. He's in a filthy mood because his batman had dropped a loaded Sten gun, which went off and shot Alistair in the hand. The bullet had lodged in his hand. And so he was there with his arm in a sling. And we thought, well, God, everything's lost. There should be a lot more men here than there are. And they should have moved off fairly soon after we arrived. But they waited, and a few stragglers came in. And eventually we did move off. But we had to, because the sky was beginning to lighten a little bit, and we wanted to get to our objectives before, whilst it was still dark. First light on D-Day was at 5:20. Now these times are all double British summertime, which was the same as the German central summertime. And when we moved off, there'd only about 140 men out of all that 750. But we'd all got great faith in Alistair Pearson, and, you know, we knew he'd been in desperate situations before. And we thought, you know, great faith, somehow he'd get us out of this. So we moved off from Toufreville east towards the village of Bure, which was on the River Dives, where there were two bridges to be blown. There was also the bridge at Troarn, what they called Troarn Bridge, which is just a hamlet called Saint Samson, which is about a mile east of Troarn. And Alistair, I think, decided that they couldn't do the Tro-Arm one, so we just go to Bure. And we stopped at the side of the forest, and at 5:20 it was the first light. And they sent me off with some others, well, maybe 10 of us went down to do a recce on the bridges, see if there was anybody there or any Germans there or anything. We went down to this village of Bure, and there's no Germans there at all. Very, very quiet, almost too quiet. And when we got there, we found that some of the Royal Engineers who had been dropped on the wrong DZ had gone straight there. Quite a march from Roundville to Bure. And so we covered them. That means, you know, we were there sort of guarding them whilst they put their charges on the bridges. And there was a railway bridge, which was quite a substantial bridge with a girder formation. There had been a railway there. It had been taken up by the Germans, I think. I think it was in early 1944. And an ordinary road bridge, which was not very substantial. And they blew up these two bridges. I think it took quite a time. I mean, all that time was passing by, and it was about 9 o'clock in the morning by the time they did that. And there was a glider that had landed in the river there, and it had an anti-tank gun in. And they got the pilot out, and he was in an awful state. He'd fractured both legs in two places, both thighs and both lower legs, like a rag doll, poor fella. And they got him out, and I think he survived. I don't know how he survived, but he did. And I'm sorry, was it altered it much?
No, it's all right.
Yeah. And we had a Jeep with us, because at least one of the Jeeps from the gliders had survived all right and was drivable. And so they took him away on that Jeep to the 224 Parachute Field Ambulance, which was up the road at about 2 miles away at a place called Le Mesnil. And they tried to get the anti-tank gun out of the glider, but they couldn't. And they even got a horse to try and pull it out, and they couldn't. But I don't know whether anybody checked to see that it would fire or not, because usually what the gunners did, if a gun was in that sort of situation, they would have taken the breech block out and thrown it away, and then nobody could have used it. Anyway, that's by the by, they couldn't get it out. And then people thought, well, we've been lucky so far. Any time the wrath of the Germans could descend on us, so we melted back into the woods. And whilst we'd been doing all this, on the main road from Tro-Arm to the coast, which we had to cross to get to Bure at right angles, if you look at my map, it will make it a lot clearer what I'm talking about. The German half... Oh, take it right out, please, and you'll see it better.
Sorry, just carry on, I'll find it.
Yeah, you can see the DZ, it's marked bottom. And anyway, this main road runs from Tro-Arm towards the coast. And up this, while we've been away, had come six German half-tracks. Half tracks have got two steerable front wheels, like an ordinary truck, and the back is a Caterpillar. The Panzer Grenadiers, and our anti-tank detachment, probably, I don't know how many, might only have been three men with a Piat, which is a spigot mortar, they call them, that's it. You put a bomb on it, on this rod, and fire it. And it'll disable even, or partially disable, the big German tank. Anyway, they knocked one or two of these half-tracks out of action, and the rest of them went back to Troarn. And they didn't know that if they'd made a big effort and gone straight on, they could have got right to Ranville or beyond. If not with the half-tracks, with some proper tanks. There wouldn't have been much to stop them. There were very few anti-tank guns available. But that action sort of certainly saved the bridgehead to a large extent, I think. I mean, it's just opinion that there was no opposition, really, but all the way from where this happened, through Escaville, Herouvillette, Ranville, right to the bridges. They would have had the German armour could have got through, but they thought there was a bigger force there with big anti-tank guns. You know, suppose these things get exaggerated, so they didn't try again. Anyway, we got on the edge of the...